Well, let me ask, since you're out of the partisan thing and you haven't yet taken the oath at Purdue, and there is this debate within the Republican Party on how to reach out or reach back to minority communities. You were able to do that in your two runs as governor, particularly in your reelection, where people actually came to the African-American community and said, hey, this is how this guy helped me. You ought to vote for him for a second term. What should your party be doing to reach out to African-Americans? Because there won't be an African-American candidate on the ballot for president 4 years from now. What should they do to reach out to Hispanics?
I think it starts with explaining those things we believe are best for America, always from the standpoint of poor people, young people, folks trying to rise in the country. Now, that comprises a lot more people than, you know, any one ethnic group. But I just think this is a little blind spot that some of my fellow Republicans have. They don't have to change what they're for, but they need to explain why they're, what motivates them, why they're for it. And we always try to do that here in the state, talking about why pro-growth policies were especially good. They're good for everybody, but they're especially good for folks trying to get that first job or trying to come up the ladder of life. And so I would start there. I mean, I think there's some other things you can look at. I've always been pro-immigration, and I think with a proper look to legitimate concerns like making the borders mean something, you can still be on your front foot about welcoming the talent we need in this country, and finding some way to recognize those who are here now, if they want to earn full citizenship. American people tend to swing the pendulum every so often, and secondly, I will be surprised if we don't have real serious difficulties these next few years. The economy is not doing well. This is, people said we need a recovery from this recovery, and we do. And I just see lots of difficulties. I think the new health care bill is going to be a big mess, and it's going to disappoint anybody who actually believed it was going to lower spending, lower deficits, lower health care costs, or believe that nobody was going to lose their health insurance that they have now. All those things are not true. So I can easily imagine that we get, as we've had in the past, the pendulum swinging back. But I agree that folks who, Republicans, if they want to be a good alternative, got some work to do.
The governor was asked about the role the Tea Party has played in Indiana and Republican politics.
Well, I don't think anybody created the Tea Party. I think it was pretty authentic, at least when it started. And the other thing that I would point out is that at least what I saw for the first year or so of this so-called phenomenon, it was all concentrated on fiscal issues and also constitutional issues, people who thought that our protections of liberty had been ignored or were being trespassed. And so These things that led to the undoing of candidates you mentioned weren't, as far as I'm concerned, sort of Tea Party in origin. But on the general point that electoral success really requires trying to get people together, yeah, you know, you're better off with folks who don't drive others away. You know, I've only ever been in three elections, counting one primary, but the way we even tried to conduct ourselves and the way we've encouraged others to do it is see what you can do to bring people together, not draw a line that you hope is on the, just barely on the plus side of 50%. And, you know, I see people in both parties who practice divisive politics. I mean, to be honest, nobody more divisive than this president. He's always blasting somebody or some group, and, you know, you can win elections that way. But if we're going to solve big problems in this country, I think we've got to be a little more inclusive and a little more practice a little more of the politics of addition.
It dominated the news here and in Washington for nearly a year. Would he run for president? Governor Daniels was asked, did he regret not running for president?
No, I don't. What good would it do anyway? But when I do think about it for a second, I think I made the only decision that was right, first for my family, but secondly, not running allowed me to honor something that always meant a lot to me. I said, and you all heard me say 1,000 times, I never ran for any office before. I'm not on the make for any other office. The decisions we're making here, you may disagree, but I want you to know we're trying to figure out what's best for the state, all of the state, and I want to see it through to the end. And so I was able to do that. And the last part I'd put on that is, you know, some things I think were really important for this state got done in year 7 and year 8. A lot of administrations run out of gas before that. And if I'd been running for president, we wouldn't have had education reform of the kind we got. We wouldn't have had another rock-solid budget and some other things I could name. So, you know, all in, I think it was a decision I'm totally at peace about.
When a politician reaches the end of his run, it's inevitable questions are asked about their legacy. The governor was asked what he thought his legacy would be.
Yeah, it's too early, and it's not for me to say. It's a very natural question I'm getting a lot these days. I guess I'm thinking about it in the following way, Nikki. We made a lot of big change, but for some of it, there's no guarantee that it lasts. So you can build the best jobs and business climate in the country, but that could be undone if we make some other decisions. You can be AAA credit and have money in the bank and a rock-solid fiscal situation, but that could change very fast. Education reform could be undone or stymied. It happened once before in Indiana, in recent Indiana history. On the other hand, there are certain things that I think are very likely to endure. We built billions of dollars of roads this state would never have had. We did it without a tax increase or a nickel borrowed, and they're going to be there for 100 years, providing jobs and safety and all the things we expect out of public assets. The land and wetlands and rivers that we have conserved and set aside, I don't see that ever being reversed. I hope it'll be extended, you know, our bicentennial nature trust and all that. The property tax cuts of 2008, we constitutionally capped. So unlike in the past, sometimes they were reduced and then they crept back up. I don't think that's like it. So some of these changes, I mean, I hope they all last, but some of them are more sure to than others. And the last answer I'll give you is a more general one. Very quickly, memories will fade about what happened here. Or even any of these specifics. What I hope won't is an attitude of higher expectations among Hoosiers. We made a lot of big changes every single year of the last 8 years. We are now, at least in some respects, admired and noticed and looked to by people in other states. And I hope we never go back. I hope experienced a little taste of what being a leadership state feels like, I hope from now on, whoever's in office, Hoosiers will just be in a higher gear. And if we start sort of drifting and just sort of resting on the oars, people will say, come on, what are we going to do next to be better?
What regrets did the governor have about policies he pursued or didn't pursue?
It's my heart talking. It's just my hope. I mean, I do think this, every survey for the last several years, people say, how's the nation doing? Terrible. People in Indiana. How's Indiana doing? Oh, pretty good. You know, there's a huge delta. Some people said they haven't seen a state where the gap is as high. In other words, the perception of the state handling itself well is dramatically different. That gives me, I think that's some indication that people feel a little bit of pride here. Somebody's written recently, Indiana's lost its inferiority complex. Yeah, exactly. That was the idea. Let's don't let it come back. Let's don't settle for mediocrity. But I can't prove it to you. I just hope that when folks think about it, they'll say this should be the normal state of affairs. We should be pushing ahead with things that are in the public interest. I've said often that I wish we'd gotten further with local government reform. I'm glad we did what we did. I think we made, we've cleaned up things like conflict of interest and nepotism and township assessors, and we've done, got a certain amount, but not as much as I would have hoped. And didn't get permission to go for the big infusion into higher ed back in 2007, when I think the time was still ripe for it. We could have put a lot of money against keeping it affordable for students, put some money into increasing the intellectual firepower of our schools. Too bad we didn't succeed with that. But, never expected to. When people say, what were you surprised about? I usually say that we got as many things done as we did because I didn't know. I hadn't been in elected office. I hadn't been in this statehouse process. I didn't know what percentage, particularly of big ideas, we'd be able to get done. If you looked at Indiana history, you'd said not too many, but it worked out a little better than that. I wish we hadn't turned on the BMV new computer system as soon as we did. It led to about a month of mess, right? I wish that we had seen that the original changes in welfare administration were too complicated and to work in practice. What looked so good on paper just collided with reality. But, you all heard us say over and over and over again that we were going to charge the ball, that we were going to be on the front foot, we were going to try things. And if you try enough things and lots of changes and improvements, you're never going to get them all right the first time. But we always thought it was better to tackle something, and if you didn't get it right on the first attempt, try not to repeat mistakes, but go back and correct it. In the case of welfare, it is now we're getting bonuses instead of penalties, and it's basically fraud-free, and it's working much quicker from the standpoint of those who are qualified.
Let me ask a question that hits your dual hats. Mm-hmm. Under your watch, universities, hey, you guys got to teach stuff that will help people get a job. Mm-hmm. At what point do you, getting ready to go into academia, and at what point do your successors have to say to the proprietary schools, you guys have to get with the program, because a lot of people, particularly minorities, go to the proprietary schools, they think they are getting the training to get the kind of job, they get the training, and then they go out in the job market, and the job market says, no, what you were taught was a bunch of malarkey, to use the vice president's term, that's not helping you. At what point, is that the next step in education reform, getting the proprietary schools to fall in line?
It may be. I mean, I don't think the issue here is limited to them. We've got a high percentage of college graduates coming out of, let's say, conventional colleges with degrees that aren't getting them jobs right now, something approaching half nationally from last year's class, as I recall. So it's not limited to the proprietary schools, but it may be more serious there. I think the answer starts with transparency and full disclosure, and across all of higher ed, I think this is very important. Schools need to be more accountable. I sure hope that at Purdue we will be a leader in this respect, because my view is, even today, Purdue is providing a very high value degree, and we ought to go out and document it and make the information available. I think it will make the school look even more attractive. I think that it's very important that the scrutiny that your question reflects is coming to higher ed. People are beginning to say, as they finally did to K-12 10 or 15 years ago, show us the results. Show potential students and their families the results. And how many of your graduates are finding work? How good a work are they finding? Are they able, if they borrowed money, are they able to pay it back with the learning that they've acquired? And some schools will, like Purdue, I believe, will be able to shine in that respect. And some schools, including some of those you just asked about, won't. They might demand for their product may dry out.
Would you be looking at, I think, what Florida is trying to do? Hey, if you major in these things, you get a deal on tuition. If you major in English or a comparative thingamajig, you pay the regular price.
It's a hard question. I'm not ready to go there yet. And because there's two, you can look at it from the other way around, which is to say that certain degrees are, first of all, more expensive to teach than some of the liberal arts, and also very likely to lead to the kind of job where you can pay the debt, you can pay back what you may have borrowed, or at least get the money back that you spent in tuition. So if you look at it that way, you'd say, no, you wouldn't want to do what Florida did. But I understand where they're headed. I mean, one way or another, we want to encourage more and more of our young people to take the hard subjects, to study math, to study science, and perhaps move on into those disciplines or engineering or things like that. So I understand why Florida is looking at it, but I don't know if they've got the right mechanism.
Governor, there may have been people listening that heard the cheers and said, wait a minute, we thought the governor's office was soundproof. Yeah. How does it feel? You're sitting in the office and either there's people protesting something in the legislature, or they're protesting you, or there are kids that are coming from all across the state and they're having a good time. And would you tell your successor there ought to be soundproofing in the office?
No, you know, that's what an interesting question. You know, first of all, no, I like the fact that our state house is as open as it is. And whether folks are here to in agreement or disagreement, they got every right to be here if they don't, if they behave themselves reasonably. And I like that very much. It's an interesting question, Amos. You know, because a governor, if not careful, can soundproof himself in other ways. Mm-hmm. And as I think you know, I've tried to do everything I can never to get soundproofed. I've tried to be out where people are, all over this great, big, diverse state of ours, staying overnight in homes, all those things, exactly because I really wanted people of all walks of life, of all backgrounds, to feel like they had a chance to get at their government, you know, through me if possible. And also, you know, not to get closed off. Soundproofed is a great word. I may borrow it for the future. Mm-hmm. It's easy to do if you're not making an effort. A lot of the issues we just talked about, I only knew about because some citizen brought it up. I only knew how lousy we used to be at child support because two ladies on bar stools in a saloon in Clay City, I still remember this, started telling me their story. And I could give you many other examples where I just wouldn't have known, and so we wouldn't have worked on something if I'd been soundproofed.
Let me ask you this. I don't think I've ever asked you this. A president of the United States visited Indiana Black Expo in 2005. I think you had something to do with that. How did that come about? Was there pushback from the White House, from Karl Rove and them, saying, well, who's this group? You know, Mitch, we love you, but, you know, who are they? They're going to boo us? They're going to throw stones? What's the deal?
No, I don't remember any particular resistance. I mean, there are always 100 invitations for every hour that a president, any president, has, and so you've always got that. Gosh, it's been a while, but no, I mean, when the IBE committee said, what do you think, is there any chance? I said, I don't know, but let's go try, and I actually think they welcomed it. It was, he was trying to find places, as a president should, to be available and to connect with Black Americans, and we had a great case. We said, hey, you know, you're not going to find very many venues as big or as prestigious as this one. And in my recollection, at least, it went through the grinder and got compared to other things. But as I recall, we got a yes answer in a fairly short and enthusiastic way.
Did you ever get feedback from the president? Because it was having been there, mm-hmm. I thought it was one of his best speeches. It wasn't a teleprompter. He was talking about things that he deeply believed in. And there's a theory of mine that if there hadn't been Katrina 6 weeks later, mm-hmm. that what he said at Expo could have resonated and could have been an opportunity for the president to reach out to African Americans. And I think Katrina kind of ruined that.
You know, that's a very interesting observation. It makes me want to go back, and I will go back and see if I can find the text or the tape of what he said. No, always spoke from the heart. People can disagree and do, of course, with decisions that he made, but this is a person who cared deeply, always. I mean, he fought really hard, of course, for things like not submerging black children in the overall averages in so-called No Child Left Behind. He was very determined on that point, that which remains in our law. I mean, so he has a heart for these things, and I think he spoke from it that day. Yeah. But it's an interesting point that was all soon washed away in at least perceptions about these larger events.
After 8 years in office, Governor Daniels was asked what he was most proud of.
Oh, gosh, there's a lot of those. I mean, a lot of the improvements that our agencies have made, I think only I have noticed. The fact that 77% of Hoosiers say they think state government is performing effectively, and that's about the top number of any state in the country, I think is a great tribute to the people who work in public service. I was just touching up a letter. I wrote every one of my coworkers, which is what I insist on calling them, in state government a letter on the first day. I just got it out and relooked at it to see, you know, how do we do? And I'm working on a letter I think I'll send on the last day. And I'll be telling them I think they're the finest public servants that I know of, and I think we can prove it because of the way we measure everything and tabulate everything. So there have been hundreds of things along the way that I feel good about that nobody much sees, but that's okay. I know, and that's enough.
The selling of the Indiana Toll Road, which got the state several billion dollars and created the Major Moves Road Construction Initiative, was a major Daniels accomplishment and criticism. The governor was asked all about that.
You know, and we've been over it and over it, and if there's any, at this point, if people don't get it, they just don't want to get it. Look, you know, we were losing money, right? What we got rid of was 75 years of losses with politicians running that as a patronage organization. Remember, they hadn't even paid off the bonds yet. Still owed money 50 years later. And, you know, it's just a regulated utility. It's just better run than it was. We got the best toll road we've ever had. More lanes, electronic tolling, 25 more state police, a free police post. We just operated as a regulated utility instead of a patronage operation the state owns. And in the meantime, every county along the road got $40 million free dollars to do anything they want with in their future. The state got a $500 million trust fund, which will be there in perpetuity, augmenting the gas tax, which is, as we all know, inadequate to today's needs. And the state got, with what was left, you know, about $3 billion of public assets, permanent public assets, that we never, ever, ever would have had. We got overpaid. I was kind of polite enough not to say it for a long time, but it's been said all over the world now, so might as well chime in. We were very fortunate to act when we did and to get the extraordinarily great bid that we got. And, you know, here's another completely incorrect thing that is sometimes said. We didn't spend a nickel on issues of today. So the idea that you borrowed from the future and the money's gone is completely bogus. I insisted every penny, except for paying off the bonds, every penny had to go into tangible assets. And so we have the trust fund, and we have the new roads and the rebuilt bridges. And they'll be there. They're bringing back a return right now in safety and jobs and convenience, and they will be doing it for the rest of our lives. So, you know, of all the changes that we've made, in most cases there's a good faith argument on the other side. People can argue about property tax caps. I understand. People can argue endlessly about the education reforms or so many of the other changes. But this one, the facts are so emphatic that, you know, that these remaining confusions are all just matters where people don't know have the facts right. Once you have the facts right, you can only come out in one place. The $120 million that Northwest Indiana got in the RDA was a one-time. It was spread over 10 years, but it was it came from the 3.9. So there was no promise that it would be a permanent program. It was meant, I should have mentioned it a minute ago, man, I mean, in that list, I mean, it was meant to try to give a big boost to the region and maybe to create a little bit of cooperation across the region that hadn't been there. And I hope it's doing that. But as to whether the state wants to come up with some other source to make it permanent, that'll be a decision for people in the future. But it gave Northwest Indiana an asset it never would have had otherwise, and I think they've used it pretty wisely, and I'd like to see it go on, but kind of depends on, in large part, on how much folks in the region want that.
The governor served 2 years as budget director under President Bush. Governor-elect Pence is becoming governor after more than a decade in Washington as a congressman. The governor was asked about that transition and pitfalls.
I don't think having done that job, remember, I lived in the state the whole time. I worked down there. I came home as often as I could, and especially after 9/11, it wasn't often enough. But I never was a citizen of any place else, never felt rooted anywhere else. You don't want a Washington mindset, let me put it this way, wouldn't help you much. I often got the question, well, must have learned a lot there, OMB. Not really. Not that applied. I think the years I spent in business had a lot more application to the work here than anything I had done in public life before. But, I guess as long as you remember that Indiana has to solve its own problems, I can't name a single big issue we've got where Washington can be more than a marginal player. And sometimes we're glad for the help of our fellow taxpayers if we have a flood or, to maybe here and there to help defray the cost of some project. But as long as no one ever starts the thought process with what are we going to ask Washington for, then I don't think it's a problem to have served there.
It's a couple things. Fights with Washington?
Well, I don't remember that we ever picked too many fights. I mean, we disagreed on a few things, but I know it frustrated our folks sometimes that I was very uninterested in going down there. I was very uninterested in governor's meetings, except where I thought I could learn something from another state. I just never saw it being very productive to focus very much on what the federal government was doing. We always thought that it was our job to try to make Indiana better, and they would be anything that anybody down there could do would be very secondary. And it's more clear to me now than if anything than it was 8 years ago.
When looking back, there's a tendency to ask what went wrong. But the governor was asked what went right with his administration. And surprisingly, the governor also talked about success with changes in how unemployment has been paid out.
It pretty well demonstrated what you heard anecdotally, that there was a lot of abuse of that system. And maybe beyond abuse, something even more troubling, and that is people getting accustomed to the idea that this is an okay way to live. Collect unemployment, maybe do a little off the books, cash business somewhere, and that's just fine. Well, it's not just fine. Unemployment was meant to bridge people over who legitimately had lost a job, and getting more serious about you are expected for this charity on behalf of your fellow citizens. You are expected to get yourself back to work, or to get the kind of training that might get you back to work. The vast majority are doing that, but you are quite correct. It turned out a very significant number of folks really weren't serious about that. And I think that that bill is working much better than people, than we projected. And we are on track to pay back the what the fund had borrowed sooner. I hope it stays on that track.
Governor Daniels made education reform a big priority, but his superintendent of public instruction, Dr. Tony Bennett, lost his reelection bid. The governor was asked, was the election of Glenda Ritz, the Democrat, a referendum on education reform or a referendum on Bennett?
I think it was a very effective personal campaign against Superintendent Bennett, in which enough people were persuaded of something about him that singled him out enough to tip him into the negative column. No. As far as I know, nobody out there supported his opponent based on, let's close all the charter schools, let's go back to only seniority matters so that good teachers are not treated any better than less effective teachers. I don't think anybody campaigned on the basis of, let's tell poor people no, you're going back to the schools, the failing schools maybe that where we tell you to, we're not going to give you the same choice that your wealthier neighbors have. I didn't see any of that. You know, I know a lot of people were told that there won't be any band or orchestra if Tony Bennett wins, which wasn't true, but then it's his campaign's fault for not going out and correcting that in time. No, in the very same election, as you saw, overwhelming majorities who were supporters of reform got elected to the legislature. Pro-reform governor got elected, so I think it was an effective campaign, but very, in a savvy way, went at Tony Bennett on personal grounds, and in some cases, less than honest ones.
Governor, let me ask you this. In one of the IPS school districts, the one that is had the most percentage of African-American votes, where the incomes are working class low, mm-hmm. The reform candidate won with 80%+ of the vote, and those same voters flipped over their ballot and were voting for Glenda Ritz. Could part of it be that people who are pushing reform really haven't explained to folks the benefits of the reform? Because I'm willing to bet you there are people whose kids were in charter schools, whose kids are taking advantage of the vouchers, who said, all right, I'm voting for Cosby for IPS school board, or I'm voting for Sam Odell, and then I'm going to flip the ballot, and I'm either voting straight for Tony Bennett, or I'm going to definitely vote against Tony, and I'm voting for Ritz.
Yeah, that's a very interesting analysis, but I guess I don't find it that surprising. Again, I think it may reflect another shortcoming of the Bennett campaign. They didn't connect. Clearly, these voters saw that some changes in education be in the interest of their children and their neighborhood from their school board ballot. But it was the job of the Bennett campaign to connect things he'd done. If not for Tony or the things he stood for, many of these changes wouldn't be there. But obviously, people didn't connect those two dots, and it's a very interesting finding. I do think it supports the fact that Superintendent Bennett was beaten on bases other than let's roll back all these reforms to 1980.
Let me follow up on the economy and your pessimism on the American economy. I don't know whether you were sent a copy of the Black Expo State of Black Youth report. Here in Marion County, 39% of black youth are in poverty, but some of the figures in some of the other cities on the state approaching third world, 50, 60, 70% in poverty. What do we need to do in Indiana to deal with our older neighborhoods and our older manufacturing cities and towns?
Well, there are things government can do and things that government, at least so far, hadn't figured out any way to do, Amos, and you know what some of these are. What government can do is certainly try to, every way to improve particularly public education or improve the education available to our kids. We all know that. You know, we brought full-day kindergarten. People sort of pocketed that and, you know, immediately jumped on to something else, but that wasn't easy. Been talked about for I don't know how many decades, and now, essentially every kid in kindergarten in the state has full-day opportunities. So, of course, that's why we work so hard on education. a pro-growth, pro-jobs policy that brings in jobs of all kinds, at all levels, has been our main preoccupation. We've worked on it every single day, and there's some, you know, we've made a lot of gains.
After I asked that question on the economy, the governor then talked about the importance of two-parent families and gave what some might say is an interesting take on same-sex couples as child caregivers.
Now, there are things and that maybe one day someone in government will find a way to do, but we certainly didn't. As intact families would make a huge difference. And but that's not something government has shown any ability to influence. But if I've always said, if they gave me that lamp, you could keep two of the three wishes. I would just wish that my one wish would be that every child in Indiana would grow up in an intact home to the age of 18. All the data tell us that that alone lifts people out of poverty, gives them a much better chance of succeeding in school, staying out of trouble, avoiding drugs, all the things that break our hearts when they happen to young people. But if somebody's got a way to do that, it's sort of like fighting obesity. We've done everything we know how, and we still have folks who smoke or make unwise health choices. And so in a job like this one, you have to ask yourself, we've only got so many days here. What are the things that can make the most difference? And those are the ones we've tried to work on. And I'm personally familiar with some folks who are going to do a very good job of parenting in a same-sex environment. I'm not saying it's preferable. I don't think the data tells us that. But people do heroic things as single parents. And we've tried to do everything we can to help them. Boy, we've worked so hard on improving
child support collection?
Support, sorry. Oh, I was thinking of child care. Now, single parents do heroic things on a daily basis, and we try to support them all we can. We really worked hard on raising child support. We got it up about 10%, but we still 40 cents or something of every dollar that a court awards, we still don't get in Indiana. The children would be better off if somehow there were two loving adults in the house, and very often then two incomes, and you know, things that just build a better base under young life.
Back on education, the governor was asked his longstanding view on appointing the superintendent of public instruction.
Fascinating that as far as we could tell, there was only one point in common between the Democratic campaign of 2004 and the Republican campaign, the platforms and so forth, and that was both parties agreed, as a matter of good government, that the superintendent should be appointed, and then we didn't get it done. Well, I can tell you the story, I guess, but I mean, clearly we were for it. It was in the stack of bills I delivered on my first day. It was in the on the roadmap that we had published. You know, it was. But as you say, it was a long list. You couldn't mention anything. I'm not sure I mentioned it in the State of the State speech. It would have been a two-hour speech if I named everything we were trying to do. No, it was an internal legislative matter, and we just. Leadership at the time just decided that was one they weren't going to move, and I couldn't persuade them. Well, you know what? I kept bringing it up because I still thought it was a good idea. I still think it was a good idea. I mean, let's remember, Indiana's number one in America in the percentage of the state budget that goes to K-12. Very few Hoosiers know this, but it's really worth noticing. 55 cents of every dollar. Why? Because we've protected K-12 spending when we were reducing darn near everything else in sight. And two, we didn't ever let Medicaid explode here and crowd it out. So anyway, 55 cents of every dollar in the current state budget goes to K-12, and yet the person with the most responsibility over education isn't necessarily aligned with the policies of the governor. And that's no longer a hypothetical, as it was before. Well, you know, I brought it up over time, but what happened the last couple of years is people said, yeah, it's still a good government idea, but it's the wrong time. Like, we shouldn't do it now because it's too close to the reelection of of Superintendent Bennett, and I understood that. You know, you wouldn't want a good government reform to look like it was a short-term political tactic. So I didn't fight with him about it. I did keep bringing it up.